Hey, listener, for a limited time, when you make a gift to the world, your donation will be matched. That means double the support for our in-depth coverage of the day's top stories, brought to you with context, perspective, and empathy. Visit theworld.org/match. Thank you.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
At the center of today's impeachment proceedings, a U.S. Army officer who was born in the Soviet Union. He began his testimony by addressing his dad.
Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fined for telling the truth.
Also today, a boarding school in Turkey takes care of Uyghur Muslim children whose parents are trapped in China.
Actually, we have never told them the full story. We always try to tell them that one day they will come here. Don't worry.
And two women set out to get married in every country that allows same-sex marriage.
Everybody was like, oh, wow, you're crazy, but it's great.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you could sum up today's impeachment proceedings on Capitol Hill in one word, it would be allegiance. Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, opened today's proceedings by painting a glowing portrait of the career service by witness Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman.
An Iraq war veteran who was awarded a Purple Heart and an expert in Russia and Ukraine who has worked at the highest levels of the Pentagon.
Testifying alongside Vindman.
Jennifer Williams is a career Foreign Service officer who is currently detailed to the office of the Vice President and responsible for Europe and Eurasia-related issues.
Both Williams and Vindman sat in on the now infamous July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky.
What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
What I found unusual or different about this call was the president's reference to specific investigations, and that struck me as different than other calls I had listened to.
Today's testimonies were, of course, to learn more about the actions of the president, but it quickly became a referendum by some Republicans about protocol. Vindman and Williams were repeatedly asked to reveal the name of the whistleblower who first came forward about that July phone call. Chairman Schiff intervened twice.
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower. Please stop. I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings.
Republicans also questioned Vindman's background and loyalties. Earlier this year, a senior Ukrainian official offered Vindman the chance to become Ukraine's defense minister. Vindman said he rejected this as comical and reported it up the proper channels. Things got especially testy when Devin Nunes, the top-ranking Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, addressed Vindman.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Ranking member, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Some Republicans, including the president, have also accused Vindman of being a never-Trumper. Democratic Congressman Jim Himes asked Vindman about that.
Colonel Vindman, would you call yourself a never-Trumper?
Representative, I'd call myself never-partisan.
Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Like many of us, he was glued to the screen today watching the hearings.
It was a disturbing morning when the Republican counsel questioned Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's loyalty to the United States. He implied he had dual loyalties. You know, he came to the United States as a refugee from the former Soviet Union. Several Republican members tried to, in effect, delegitimize Lieutenant Colonel Vindman by diminishing the importance of his specific role at the White House. And the White House even attacked him on Twitter while he was testifying. I think that's a new low. I've never seen a White House go after a White House employee, especially a decorated combat veteran.
There was one key moment that came in Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's opening statement when he said that if he were offering the same sort of testimony in many other countries, it would not be tolerated. Like in Russia, he said, testifying against the head of state would surely cost him his life. And then he said this.
Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fined for telling the truth.
Right. And as you said, Ambassador Burns, it was in 79 that a 3-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Vindman came with his father and his twin brother to settle in the U.S. That's a context for that comment. How and where will that comment resonate?
It was a powerful moment for any American whose family came from overseas. That would be almost 100% of us. As an immigrant nation, he came as a refugee, he and his families. And I thought it was very profound that he would say that, particularly because he came from the Soviet Union, an authoritarian dictatorship. And his job right now at the White House staff is to try to have the United States help Ukraine resist authoritarian dictatorship from Russia, the successor state to the Soviet Union.
So as you notice, Republican lawmakers used their time to hammer on a number of issues, including the role of Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter and the Ukrainian energy company Burisma. Here's Representative Devin Nunes, a Republican from California, questioning Jennifer Williams. She's an aide to Vice President Mike Pence.
Did you know that financial records show a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to American accounts tied to Hunter Biden?
No, I was not aware.
Until you prepared for this hearing?
Until others have been testifying in more detail on those issues.
Ambassador Nick Burns, you're an advisor to the Biden campaign. By repeating these concerns about Biden over and over, the Biden critics simply create a narrative of wrongdoing, even without evidence. Isn't that a real worry for the campaign?
You know, I think it's an attempt by the Republicans to change the subject. The subject here is whether President Trump abused the power of his office. It's not about Burisma. It's not about anything that Vice President Biden did. But I will correct the record because Congressman Nunes got it exactly wrong, probably intentionally wrong this morning. When Vice President Biden was working on this issue, he was working as part of an American effort, a European Union effort, and an IMF, International Monetary Fund effort, to try to curb corruption in Ukraine. And the facts were just all wrong.
Yeah, but in changing the subject, isn't that a problem for the Biden campaign going forward?
I don't think so necessarily, because I think if you juxtapose President Trump versus Vice President Biden, the contrast actually plays to the advantage of Vice President Biden.
There was this moment when Representative Devin Nunes, in his questioning of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, tried to tease out the identity of the whistleblower.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings.
That was Representative Adam Schiff interrupting Nunes, saying he wants to protect the whistleblower. Ambassador Burns, why is Nunes heading down this path? What's he trying to achieve?
It's another diversionary tactic. They want to reveal the name of the whistleblower. I find this particularly shameful, that they would try to out someone who doesn't obviously wants to remain private. And I thought the Republicans skated far too close to the line on that.
Nicholas Burns, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He's now a professor of diplomacy and international relations at Harvard. Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The Trump administration has upended 4 decades of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said yesterday that Israeli settlements are no longer a violation of international law. Roughly 700,000 Israelis live in settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, land that is also claimed by Palestinians. Israeli leaders welcomed the Trump administration's decision. Palestinians, as well as nations across the world, warned that the move undermines hope for a broader peace deal. Joining us from Tel Aviv is Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under President Obama. Ambassador, what makes this shift in policy so important?
The truth is that it's more symbolic than actual. Every administration since the Carter administration voiced their opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the West Bank without making reference to the legal question. It was on policy grounds. What's important about it, however, is that it seems to give a green light, and that's quite different from any previous administration, to significant expansion of Israeli settlement, and at a time when advocates for Israeli settlement expansion are also talking about unilateral annexation of the West Bank or portions of the West Bank. Clearly, those steps would make it much, much harder to ever achieve a two-state solution. And since President Trump has never endorsed a two-state solution, it appears to be a continuation of an effort, essentially, to move us away from that track and kill off that option.
What reaction have you heard about this announcement in Israel and the occupied territories?
For many Israelis, they are appreciative of it because at least some Israeli settlements are not particularly controversial. They're consensus points in Israel, the ones that are larger and closer to the pre-1967 borders, and which most peace plans have envisioned Israel retaining in a kind of a land swap. But overall, it's consistent with the Israeli view that settlements are not illegal under international law. And so it's been received positively by both the prime minister and the leader of the opposition.
And what about Palestinians? What about opinion in the West Bank?
Palestinians certainly strongly oppose any settlement construction. They always have. They weren't thrilled with the policy of previous administrations either that didn't focus on the illegal question and also didn't necessarily succeed in stopping Israeli settlement. But I think they view this decision by the Trump administration as the latest in a series of blows to the administration's ability to serve as any kind of mediator.
In the final days of the Obama administration, under which you served as ambassador to Israel, the U.S. allowed the U.N. Security Council to pass a resolution declaring the settlements a flagrant violation of international law. If that was the feeling of the Obama White House, why wait until the final days of 8 years of making policy to ratchet things up?
And that was an abstention on a resolution that the Obama administration did not draft, but came at a time when there were settlement expansions happening. Every previous administration also found itself in a situation in which Security Council resolutions came before them, which included language which was not identical to U.S. policy, but which ultimately they abstained on and allowed to pass because the United States has been quite isolated on this question about illegality of Israeli settlements vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
Well, Jared Kushner's peace plan turns out to be a little more than a flashy economic program with no clear roadmap to peace. There's Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the relocation of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and the closure of the Palestinian diplomatic office in Washington, and the declaration that the Golan Heights is Israeli sovereign territory. When you stack all this up, what is U.S. policy in the Mideast?
The administration has held out the prospect of a plan that would lay out their policy for now nearly 3 years. That plan has never been presented, and it's not clear it ever will be presented. But every indication is that the Trump administration's view of the end state that it hopes to see in this part of the world is Israeli annexation of wide swaths of the West Bank, where settlements exist, and even beyond those areas. And around that, isolated islands of limited Palestinian autonomy.
Are you describing a one-state solution?
It's not a solution. It's probably a one-state outcome, or we might call it a binational state outcome. It also is not very sustainable, in my judgment, and it won't be the policy of a successor administration, perhaps as early as 14 months from now, if a Democratic president takes office.
So elaborate on that. Where do you see hope for a two-state solution still?
It would take tremendous leadership from Israelis and Palestinians, and with American support from Arab leaders, to, first of all, convince very disillusioned publics that it's even possible. None of this is possible in the current leadership constellation. In fact, I think a realistic policy of the next administration, if it wants to restore the two-state solution as the center to the American policy, is not to say we want to achieve a two-state solution, but rather we want to find ways to stabilize it and keep it alive for later. At the moment, two-state solution is certainly not in the cards. The risk is that it goes over the cliff and is not achievable even later when different and bolder leadership is in place.
Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under President Obama, thanks very much for your thoughts.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. China's crackdown on ethnic Uyghurs is increasingly clear. As many as 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities are being held in what China calls re-education camps. According to documents obtained by the New York Times, the Chinese leadership is intent on crushing any hint of a separatist movement. These policies have separated countless families. In Turkey, dozens of Uyghur children are cared for at a boarding school while their parents are trapped back in China. Duri Baskaran reports from Istanbul.
The 11-year-old boy has a slight frame, but a wide smile. His favorite class at school is art. His favorite dinner is chicken with noodles. And when I ask him to introduce himself, this is the first thing on his mind.
I wish freedom for my country, and I want to fight for the freedom of my country.
The country he's referring to is East Turkestan, the term many Uyghurs use to describe China's northwestern Xinjiang province and their hopes for its independence. Here in Istanbul, thousands of miles away, 33 boys live in a boarding school for Uyghur children who have been separated from their parents. Mohammed Izzatullah is in charge of caring for the children's daily needs. He says in most cases, the children arrived in Turkey with their parents for what was supposed to be a temporary visit. When the parents realized how bad things were getting in Xinjiang, they returned to China to get their affairs in order.
They decide to put their children to someone they know and go back and try to sell their houses, their business, collect all their value and come back.
But once they returned to China, the parents were detained.
They never come back.
Uyghur community leaders say up to 400 children are here in Turkey without their parents. These 33 boys were the first to attend this school because their living situations were considered the most unstable. In the dormitory, bunk beds sleep four boys to a room. A list of chores is on the wall. Izzatullah tells me that the staff here avoid talking to the kids about what's happening to their parents back in China, but that doesn't keep the boys from worrying.
Sometimes they isolate themselves and really sad about it. He tries everything he can to help them, but actually he don't really know what to do, and it happens a lot.
Usually he takes them aside, tries to kick around a ball and get their mind off of it. If all else fails, he takes them to the mall for ice cream, a new toy, anything.
It was especially difficult in the beginning, but by the time they start to get used to it and it's getting a little bit better.
Izzatullah knows the pain of separation. He's also alone in Turkey. His wife and 9-year-old daughter are thousands of miles away in Xinjiang.
They had bought a flight ticket, but suddenly government start collecting all passports from Uyghurs. That's how they stuck.
Taking care of the kids here, he says, is one way he can feel normal. As the sun sets, a group of girls play a duck-duck-goose game with a teacher. About 100 children are non-boarding students who take Uyghur classes here. They stay with relatives nearby. Iman Yaqob is raising two of his grandchildren. He has a shop where he sells fruit and vegetables that are hard to come by in Turkey, like Chinese long beans and chives. It's not easy compared to the comfortable life he used to lead in China, but nothing compares to how hard it is for him and his wife to be parents to their grandkids.
Yeah, we try to take care of them as good as we can, but of course we can never do the same as our own parents.
The children's parents and two brothers are still in China, he says.
Actually, we have never told them the true story. We always try to tell them that one day they will come here. Don't worry.
His 8-year-old granddaughter is a bit shy, but she tells me she likes school. Math is her favorite subject.
She liked to play with her friend and doing homework together, singing together.
Uyghur community leaders say that as far as they know, this boarding school is the only one of its kind. The school stays afloat with donations from a group of Uyghur businessmen that the director, Habibullah Kusemi, prefers not to name. As for the children themselves, he says, he worries about their safety all the time.
We know there have been statements from Chinese police that wherever we are in the world, they will reach them and put them back in the jail.
It's impossible to keep something like this a secret, he says. The location of the school, the identities of the kids, they have to assume the government knows everything.
So we worry. We do everything we can to keep them safe.
Most of the children here know that their parents are detained in camps, Kusemi says. In some cases, they've received word that their parents have died in custody. And that puts a big question mark on their future. Without their parents, living alone in a foreign country, what are their options? As the kids gather for dinner, Kusemi says his goal is to keep the students housed and cared for until they can go to university.
We have a responsibility to the nation to keep our identity, and the language is the most important element to keep our national identity.
Without that, he says, we wouldn't be Uyghurs anymore. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Across the world, people are on the move. Along the way, sometimes culture gets lost. Connections to language, food, music, identity. Iranian singer and musician Azam Ali has a new album out called Phantoms. On the title track, she talks about that loss of identity.
It's about all the different personas that we develop over time and how we learn to move through them fluidly until they become just part of us. It's always through hardships that either us or our parents decide to emigrate so that they can offer their children a better life. My mom left and sent me to India, so I left Iran, going to India, and then from India, coming to the US. It's never easy when you have to tear your life down, and it does something to you. It was really a remarkable journey for me, and I think at the end it really did become about reconciliation with the phantoms that live inside me.
That's Iranian singer and musician Azam Ali talking about the title track to her new album, Phantoms. You're listening to The World. The U.S. government wants American companies to stop using equipment from Chinese tech giant Huawei because of security risks. But is that all there is to it?
It's hard to say how much of this is about security and espionage, how much of this is about economic dominance and other trade issues.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Think about the networks that bring us our internet, our TV, our phone service. I'm talking about physical infrastructure here, routers, cables, switches, transmitters, and other hardware. Several companies around the world make these parts. One of them is China's Huawei Technologies. But U.S. carriers that use Huawei's equipment may soon have to rip it out of their networks because of security concerns. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports.
Laurel Highland Total Communications is this small telecom company based in Pennsylvania. Its CEO, Jim Kale, he told me that the company has always had a niche.
We started to provide phone service where the large carriers didn't want to serve.
He's talking about sparsely populated rural areas of the state. Laurel Highland still brings phone service to those areas. In fact, the landline Kale and I spoke on, it was a Laurel Highland line. But besides that, today the company also provides internet and cable TV. And if you look closely at the equipment that brings those services to customers, you'll find this one piece made by the Chinese company Huawei. Kale told me his company started using it about 5 years ago because Huawei's prices were really good.
In addition to that, it was a very large company, hungry to do business with a small company like ours. Generally, have large carriers like that or large providers are not, you know, they don't have any interest if numbers are too small.
And so Kale went with Huawei. It seemed like the sensible business decision at the time, but not so much anymore.
We're talking about potentially having to rip and replace that equipment to swap it out with something else.
On Friday, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is set to vote on a set of proposals targeting some carriers that use equipment made by Huawei and this other Chinese company called ZTE. It's not the big guys who use this equipment like AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, but small rural carriers like Kale's. If the proposals pass, about a dozen of them would have to remove the Chinese parts from their networks. And for Kale, that would cost about $1 million. And he says it would cause a major disruption because he'd have to pull off crews working on networks in other underserved areas of the state.
And then have them come back and retrench and swap out this equipment that's been perfectly reliable.
Perfectly reliable, according to Kale, but a major security threat, according to U.S. intelligence officials. They say the equipment has major vulnerabilities, backdoors that the Chinese government can use to enter networks undetected and spy on Americans and their businesses. This allegation that Huawei technology comes with major security risks, it started years before Trump took office. But under Trump, the U.S. government has embarked on an unprecedented campaign to keep Huawei out of U.S. networks and to get its allies to do the same. That campaign has focused mostly on 5G, the newest generation of mobile networks, an area where Huawei is considered an industry leader. Here's Josephine Wolf. She teaches cybersecurity policy at Tufts University.
I think there are so many different things kind of tied up together in this story that it's hard to say how much of this is about security and espionage, how much of this is about economic dominance and controlling the 5G standards and networks moving forward, how much of this is about sort of other trade issues.
I asked Wolf if she's seen compelling evidence coming from the U.S. government that proves that Huawei poses security risks.
So much of the intelligence, if it exists, has stayed classified about what these security threats are. So it's very hard for those of us outside government to really determine, are there actual, credible, serious current security threats coming out of Huawei? Or is this just about kind of the possibility of that happening in the future and the fear of China's economic growth?
What does worry Wolf and other security experts is the close relationship between China's government and its private sector and the power the Chinese government has to get access to private companies' data and systems. I put that concern to Andy Purdy, Huawei's chief security officer here in the U.S.
It's really a misstatement to say that Huawei has a particularly close relationship with the China government. There is nothing that they do or can do to force us to do anything, particularly where we don't have access to the kind of data that the U.S. government's worried about.
Purdy says what's happening here has less to do with Huawei and more to do with the current U.S.-China relationship. As for Jim Kale, the CEO of the small Pennsylvania telecom company, he feels caught in the middle.
You know, we're patriots. My allegiance is to my own country here. It's not to China. There truly was a risk. There truly was a threat. And show me the evidence here. We're not going to be jeopardizing our network just to make a buck.
So far, he hasn't seen that evidence. If he had, he told me, he would have ripped out the Huawei equipment from his network right away. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Two hostages, American and Australian professors, have been released by the Taliban after 3 years. In exchange, Afghanistan let go of three Taliban prisoners. They are members of the Haqqani Network, a wing of the Taliban known for violent attacks against civilians. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani brokered the deal. The swap comes as peace talks between the U.S., the Taliban, and Afghanistan have stalled. With us is Hamid Shuja with the BBC's Pashto service. Take us back to 2016. Why were Mr. King and Mr. Weeks targeted in the first place?
So basically, they were two professors who went to teach at the American University of Afghanistan. But of course, for some Taliban militants, that university itself is a symbol of American invasion in their words. And they were targeted for that. They do not just go out and randomly pick Westerners from the streets of Kabul. Obviously, there is a lot of tactical planning that goes into such abductions by the Taliban.
And in exchange for Weeks and King, the Afghan government has now released three prisoners. Who are they?
One of them is, we could call him high profile in the sense that he's the younger brother of the leader of the Haqqani network. His name is Anas Haqqani, and the other two are not as high profile. One of them is a relative of the Haqqanis. The other one is a brother of a Taliban leader who was in Guantanamo in Cuba. So the high profile figure out of the three is Anas Haqqani.
Critics of this swap claim it's only going to increase attacks against Western foreigners like aid workers. What do you think?
There is there should be no doubt that this will embolden the Taliban. Some call it a risky business for the Afghan president, Mohammad Ashraf Ghani. The question is, what does he get in return? Some would say nothing, actually. Well, he did say he is releasing these three people in return for the Taliban to come to the negotiating table. Well, the Taliban have been negotiating with the Americans, but there is no indication that they will actually agree to sit down and talk face to face to the Afghan government. And there is internal pressure as well, because a lot of people within the government were against this kind of a release, because the Haqqani network is responsible for some of the deadliest attacks against Western and Afghan forces, and collateral damage is part of it. A lot of civilians have been killed in these attacks. So there is pressure on President Ghani.
Yeah, I mean, he did take a risk. That's what a lot of critics say about this prisoner swap. What will it take to keep the momentum going in the direction of peace?
The peace talks itself is quite a process. It depends on what we mean by peace talks. There are negotiations between the Americans and the Taliban in Qatar, 9 round of talks. And in last September, President Trump suddenly announced that it's the end of it. He will not talk to them again. That's one process. In the meantime, there have been intra-Afghan dialogues between the Taliban and some Afghan social activists and politicians and a few members of the Afghan government as well. The third part, which hasn't actually happened yet and could be the most important one, is when and if the Taliban actually sit down with the Afghan government. But signs so far show that the Taliban will be difficult to convince to sit down with the Afghan government.
The White House, in a statement released about this prisoner swap, there was no indication that this would jumpstart talks. So where is the hope that they will even resume?
There is no such hope. Since September, there has been no signal from either the Americans or the Taliban themselves for the resumption of direct negotiations between the two sides. Other people have been urging them. European Union have urged both sides to sit down again. China has even urged both sides to sit down again. The United Nations, the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has called on both sides to resume talks, but no indication from either the Taliban or the Americans so far. The Afghan government has always called for direct negotiations with the Taliban, but that hasn't happened yet.
Do we know at this point what Mr. King and Mr. Weeks are planning on doing next?
Right now, they are with the U.S. military and they are being looked after by the medical team within the U.S. military. I don't think they have left Afghanistan yet. The next step would be for them to be reunited with their families and loved ones. When does that happen? We do not exactly know.
Hamid Shujo with the BBC's Pashto service. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
When Fleur Pirates and Julian Boom got married in 2017, only 22 countries worldwide allowed same-sex marriage. The two women, Fleur, who is Belgian, and Julian is Dutch, thought, why not get married in all 22 of them? But after their fourth wedding in Paris, Julian was diagnosed with brain cancer. She died about 7 weeks later. But the story did not end there. Fleur Pirates completed the wedding journey in a new children's book, Love Around the World. She told me she first met her wife at a party in Amsterdam.
And we fell in love instantly, and which was kind of weird because I have been married to a man for 10 years. And suddenly I fell in love with a girl. So I was labeled a lesbian, which was kind of weird at the time. The thing was, we were both artists. So we decided to work together. And over time, we became more and more activists and advocates for LGBT rights.
So how did this whole idea get hatched to get married in 22 different nations? And I should point out that as of now, 28 countries now allow same-sex marriage.
Yes. Well, it came about at one evening. We were sitting at a table with four of our friends, very open-minded friends, and they didn't know that we only could get married in 22 countries. So we thought it was very important to make a project about that, because change starts with knowledge. So we thought if we can get it out there, that number, people are shocked because people think everything is quite all right with LGBT rights, but actually it isn't.
So you were just out at dinner and a light bulb went off and you and Julian said, hey, let's get married 22 times.
Yeah, that's weird, right?
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, this is a really uplifting book, but it also kind of underscores the fact that you're still unable to get married in 170 plus countries. I mean, do you see this book as kind of, it's a children's book, but it's also a work of activism?
It is very much a work of activism, because I would love to point out that you can love whomever you want, you know, because love is love. And what does it matter? Because there are still 71 countries where homosexuality is illegal. In 12 countries, there's a death penalty to homosexuality. That's completely crazy. So I think if that would change a bit, you know, children are our future. These are the ones who have to do it later on. So I think if they can start with an open mind, and hopefully this book is a little part of that.
I mean, these weren't just weddings, though. I mean, they've been described as performance art pieces.
Yes.
Explain what that means. And what that looks
well,
like.
Well, the thing is, of course, we're not going to get married 22 times with a party, because that's, you cannot pay for that. That's so expensive. So we just wanted an official in an official place getting us married, and we will put a camera there and we will just stream it online. So that was the whole project, to do that 22 times in all the different countries.
Mm.
So, but then again, of course, it still stayed very expensive. So we didn't have the money to make the project, but we figured out that if we sold everything we had, we would make it to 5 weddings. And after that, we hoped for an airplane or a bus company to sponsor us in our travel expenses, or we could sleep on people's couches. So we sold everything. We ended up with each one suitcase. But then, of course, after 4 weddings, she died, and I was left with 2 suitcases. That was all I had in the whole world.
Mm. One of the striking things about this book are the illustrations by artist Fatina Ramos. You both depict cultures of these different places so vividly in writing and in pictures. Do you have one favorite wedding of the 4 that you had with Julian, and what made it your favorite?
It was the U.S. because
really?
I'm from Belgium. She's from Holland, but we really decided that New York had to be the first wedding, because the thing is, you know, in Belgium and Holland, people are like, don't be crazy. You know, every idea that you have is very easily pointed out as megalomaniac. So when we told our story in New York, everybody was like, oh, wow, you're crazy, but it's great. So we actually needed that U.S. energy to get it started.
I feel a kinship there. My mom got married at City Hall in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so great.
Fleur Peretz, the author of Love Around the World, a new children's book. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Australia is only at the beginning of its fire season, and it can't catch a break. Strong winds and high temperatures are stoking 130 separate wildfires across Australia's east coast. 4 people have died, and 2.5 million acres have burned. That's like almost half of New Jersey. The BBC's Shaima Khalil reports from the Australian state of New South Wales.
The smell of smoke is the first thing that hits you when you step out in this part of the forest in Nana Glen. I am in a forest surrounded by blackened tree trunks. There's almost no color here, but the black from the charred trees and the gray in the sky above, full of smoke. The ground here is completely scorched. You could feel the heat beneath, and actually some areas are smoldering still.
Across the dirt road from the burnt-out trees, Warren Smith, the local mechanic, guides me through the rubble of the place he called home. As the catastrophic flames raged, a fireball shot across, and the whole house exploded.
There's nothing here. There's nothing salvageable. There's nothing to be salvaged out of the place. It's just an absolute wreck.
How long have you lived here for, Warren?
Just under 22 years. It was a family house. The memories come back, and it's just very, very sad. Seeing it the way it is, the emotions start kicking in, the voice changes, the tears come in. So,
Warren's neighbour Helen evacuated before the catastrophic fire hit.
It's never happened like this before. And especially when you look at the, I mean, how many fires did they quote? They had 100 fires burning in one day. Yeah, out of control? No. This is climate change, and this is the effect we're having on the planet.
Group 4, Glenray 1, you copy?
In the local Glenray fire station, Daryl Watt, the fire brigade captain, is getting ready for difficult times ahead.
Everyone is incredibly tired here. Emotions are getting a bit high around the place because everyone's so tired. Basically, all we need is rain, to be honest. Rain is all we need, and it'll be all over. Until it rains, we're just going to keep fighting fires for months and months and months.
When you get in here, just come in and we'll give you instructions for your tasking, over.
Comrade 7, copy. Yeah.
As their shift was about to end, three firefighters in Daryl's team head out quickly to respond to a potential threat. The smallest incident can turn into a disaster here, and they take no chances.
Stay safe.
The massive bushfires that have raged across Australia are expected to flare up again as the drought continues and the temperatures rise. Everyone here is bracing themselves for what this new threat might mean for them in the coming days.
Our BBC colleague Shaima Halil there reporting in New South Wales, Australia. Let's get back to the big story out of Washington today. Of course, I'm talking the impeachment inquiry. The House heard testimony from four witnesses. The World's Matthew Bell has been watching the proceedings, and he's in the studio with me now. So remind us who we heard from today, Matthew.
First up was Jennifer Williams. She's a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Mike Pence. Alongside her was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's a Ukraine and Russia expert on the National Security Council. Remember that both Williams and Vindman were on that July 25th phone call between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. Both of them said they were troubled by what they heard. That's really why they're there testifying today. The Republicans, again, they dismissed the whole process of the way the impeachment inquiry is being carried out, saying this wasn't fair. They pointed out that neither Williams nor Vindman ever met face-to-face with President Trump. In the case of Vindman, Marco, the Republicans and their lawyer really tried to raise questions about his character, about his loyalty to the United States. Here's Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio. He's referring here to previous testimony from Vindman's former boss at the NSC, Timothy Morrison.
Mr. Morrison said this: I had concerns about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's judgment. Among the discussions I had with Dr. Hill in the transition was our team, its strength, its weaknesses, and Fiona and others had raised concerns about Alex's judgment. When Mr. Morris was asked by Mr. Castor, did anyone ever bring concerns to you that they believe Colonel Vindman may have leaked something? Mr. Morrison replied, yes.
Wow. So, Matthew, how did the witness respond to that?
Vindman denied that he leaked anything. He denied that he knew the whistleblower, that he was in touch with the whistleblower. Fiona Hill, by the way, mentioned there, is Vindman's boss. She's the National Security Council Russia expert. Vindman seemed prepared for this, though. He immediately pulled out a statement from his own evaluation, his personnel evaluation from Fiona Hill, and read this line: Alex is a top 1% military officer and the best Army officer I have worked with.
Then we heard from a couple of witnesses that the Republicans called on. Who were they?
That's Tim Morrison, mentioned before. Mm-hmm. He's from the National Security Council. And then maybe more importantly to the whole story is Kurt Volker, who was President Trump's special envoy for Ukraine. He was at the center of a lot of this stuff that we've been learning about. What struck me about Volker's testimony today was that he didn't really undercut the central narrative that the Democrats have been trying to establish in these hearings. Here's some of what Volker had to say.
I don't think that raising 2016 elections or Vice President Biden or these things I consider to be conspiracy theories that have been circulated by the Ukrainians, particularly the former prosecutor general, are sort of... They're not things that we should be pursuing as part of our national security strategy with Ukraine.
Right. So Kurt Volker there and Tim Morrison still testifying as we chat. Now, back to Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified earlier in the day, Matthew. His family came up a few times during the hearing.
Right. It came up in his opening statement. Vindman gave a real shout out to his father, praised his courage for making the decision to bring the whole family to America. He said, "Dad, don't worry. I'll be okay for telling the truth." Later on in the hearing, New York Democrat Sean Patrick Maloney picked up on this. Let's hear some of that exchange.
"And he would have worried if you were putting yourself up against the President of the United States. Is that right?"
"He deeply worried about it because in his context, there was the ultimate risk."
"And why do you have confidence that you can do that and tell your dad not to worry?"
"Congressman, because this is America. This is the country I've served and defended, that all of my brothers have served, and here, right matters."
"Thank you, sir. Yield back."
That, of course, was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman testifying today at the impeachment hearings. Plenty more to talk about the rest of this week, Matthew. More hearings tomorrow, right?
Right. Tomorrow is going to be interesting. Ambassador Gordon Sondland will testify. He's probably the character who was closest to President Trump that we will be hearing directly from, at least so far.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you.
As we said, more testimony tomorrow. For today, though, that takes care of business here at The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.